21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm what's left of Dr. Bob Hieronymus and his incarnation friends, and our executive producer and research assistant and my boss is Laura Courtney. Our engineer is Matt Constantini. I have a very good friend whose name was Brian Constantini that I went, is he linked to? He is! Hot dog! Matt, say hello to Uncle Brian for me. Thank you. Tell him I really appreciate his last email. All right, and of course, Tom Carey is our guest. He's the co-author of Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Washington, of Wright-Patterson, with Don Schmidt, New Page Books, RoswellInvestigator.com, and you can always find links to our guests and their books on 21st Century Radio's Facebook page or on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Gosh, Rudy, I want to talk about something that is possibly in what we might call that blue room or storing room, is called memory metal. What is memory metal, and why was it?
Memory metal is a moniker that we gave to one of the types of wreckage that the witnesses who handled it and saw it had reported to us. The most of the wreckage resembled very thin foil aluminum, but was very strong. You couldn't bend it, you couldn't deform it or scratch it or mutilate it in any way. And this covered a sheep pasture about a mile long by about 300 feet wide, as reported by Jesse Marcel Sr., the first military person to get out there with the rancher back in 1947. So you have all this thin material. Well, another type of well, let's call it metal, that was reported, and there was a lot of it, we have dubbed memory metal. And we say that because the witnesses all told us that you could take this metal, and they were in little pieces about the size of the palm of your hand, a lot of it, and you could wad it up in your hand, and it felt like you had nothing in your hand. Then you would hold it over a flat surface and let it go, and before it hit the surface, it would flatten right out to its original shape without a crease. And you put a blowtorch to it, nothing would happen, it would stay cool. You would take scissors or something to it to try to cut it, you couldn't cut it, you couldn't burn it, you couldn't scratch it. There was nothing you could do to this memory metal, which, and we call it that because it remembers its original shape. And we'd go back to its original shape after you wadded it up in your hand. So that's why we call it memory metal. And there was a lot of it. And what happened was that after it got transported to Wright-Patterson, of course they wanted to know what made this tick. What was this stuff? What was it made out of? And what could it be used for? So they farmed out a project to Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, which was like a think tank, but it did a lot of engineering work. And it was close to Wright-Patterson, so it was a natural to give them projects to do. So thanks to an investigator in Florida named Anthony Bregaglia, we have learned that the Battelle Memorial Institute did conduct a study of what this stuff was made out of, mostly titanium and some other element, and what happened to it. And there were several reports that were authored by the scientists at Battelle to Wright-Patterson, who commissioned a study. And it took Anthony and a newspaper reporter in Sarasota by the name of Billy Cox several years of Freedom of Information Act requests to get copies of those reports. They were heavily redacted, of course. And what they redacted was the why this study was being done and under what was the inspiration for this study, which, of course, was the Roswell incident. So that part was redacted, but they did this study, and in 1962, the Naval Ordnance Lab had already become involved in this, and they announced the creation of something called Nitinol, N-I-T-I-N-O-L. And you can Google that on your computer, and a whole lot of stuff will come up about Nitinol. Well, what Nitinol is, it's a shape recovery metal, which is our best imitation of the Roswell memory metal. Of course, nobody will say that, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's used, you can buy it by the roll, you can buy it by the sheet, you can buy it by the coil, and it's now being used in our space program. It's already been taken aloft to see for what reasons we are not privy to, but it's shape-shifting, metal morphing. That's what it is, and it has this inspiration, we know for sure, from the Roswell incident, because these studies began in 1948 at Battelle, and that's shortly after the Roswell incident, and we actually have one or two people who were involved in that describing to us how someone came in one day and dumped a whole bunch of this on his desk, and the word was, okay, try to figure out what this is. Mm-hmm. And they went on to describe for me the memory metal. So,
well,
that's what it is. And, Bob, I can tell you this. A couple of years ago, we had a witness. This fellow was a member of the Air Force, Army Air Corps, back in 47, stationed at Roswell. And he was in the hangar where all this stuff was stored. When they brought it in from the desert, they stored it in hangar P3, which is Building 84 today. The building is still there. And he came up to Don Schmidt and I a few years ago. He said that he was at this hangar, and the thing about it was there was not a moving part amongst the wreckage, not a moving part, not one. And he says, by golly, I want to know how that thing flew. If you guys ever find out what made that thing fly, what the engine was, please tell me. Well, about a year ago, I found out what the engine was, and I went to tell this fellow, and he had just passed away two months prior.
Oh, too bad.
His name was William Ennis. He was a sergeant back in 47, and he had just passed away before I found out what made that thing fly. So that was certainly a disappointment for us.
Well, it may have been.
And the thing that made it fly, Bob, was the memory metal. That was the engine.
Engine. This is truly amazing stuff. I mean, really, from the standpoint. As you note here, you said nitinol or other morphing metals may hold the key to cosmic propulsion and infinitely free energy using the nitinol heat engines. That's an extraordinary statement,
yes.
Tom. I mean, we can resolve the big problems here in the world. Of course,
somehow,
the oil company's not going to like it. What's that, sir?
Somehow the alien entities, whoever and wherever, whoever they are and wherever they were from, they were able to harness the engine, the energy created when this metal morphed, if we want to call it metal. Whenever it morphed, free energy was created. That was done in experiments by Battelle. They were able to determine that. As soon as I read that, when I read that passage, I got a chill down my back because I said, aha. Mm-hmm. There's the engine. That was the engine. They were somehow able to control this morphing and this creation of energy. They were able to somehow control that into a propulsion system. Now, I don't pretend to know how they did it, but that's what it was, because there were no moving parts. And if you're creating energy and you're that smart, you can figure out how to make it work for you. And they made it work for them to traverse the universe from wherever they're from.
Well, so, that's, again, this is one of the important things about this book. There are scores of things like that with inside the real Area 51. Stuff that I have not seen in other books. Of course, I think we all heard something all about 10 or 15 years ago that when they were looking for an energy source or the mechanism by which they flew, there was some discussion over that by using your hands, just using certain their hands, alien hands or something, that they were able to manipulate the craft from that standpoint. Remember those days?
Yes, we are looking at that. We're just starting to look at that, and it appears that the motive you don't have to get behind a dashboard and put it in gear or something. It's most likely mental. They somehow can control it mentally. Or, like you say, maybe just put your hands somewhere, you know. But it's probably something that's thought controlled. And I don't particularly know a whole lot about this. But as we progress on this, these sorts of things come up. And I talked this week with Anthony Bregaglia, who did the yeoman work on this nitinol and the memory metal, and he has come to the same conclusion that it is the engine, but somehow it's controlled mentally, and it really gets into another realm. We're not there yet as to finding out how they actually did it, but most astronomers and astrophysicists, because how can you travel the universe that the distances are so great? Well, their conclusion is, to travel the universe, you must somehow bend space and time to your advantage, to where instead of traveling quadrillion miles, you're actually traveling just a small ways by bending the universe. And I don't pretend to understand how that is possible, but that's what it has to be, something like that, to where you shrink time and distance to jump from one place to another. But we haven't figured that out yet.
Well, let's move on to another heroine of mine. June Crane. Yes. Boy, here, yes. let's have this lady run for president or something. No, really.
Unfortunately, she's dead.
I know, but she probably would do better than most, even if she's passed on. So tell us about June Crane. Who was she? What did she accomplish? Well, I'm getting strange looks from my producer who's saying no. No, no, we have enough time to do that. Okay, go right ahead, please, Tom.
Okay, June Crane was a clerk typist with a top secret Q clearance. A Q clearance allows you to type memos and letters and stuff like that, and with atomic bombs and atomic energy. It's above top secret. It's the highest secret clearance they had at Wright Field. And she was a clerk typist from 1942 to 1952 during the period when the Roswell material came in, and she was involved in typing up memoranda and interviewing people and mostly overhearing the scientists, because she worked in foreign technology, overhearing the scientists talk about the bodies and the wreckage and the aliens and the whole ball of wax, just as a matter of daily conversation, Nothing alarming. It was just a matter of fact, and that's the way they talked about it. Well, she had a firsthand experience. One day, a officer came in and took out a piece of memory metal and put it on her desk. He said, "June, tell me what you think of that." And so she picks it up and she starts handling it. She says, "What is this stuff? I've never seen anything like it. Where did you get this?" He says, "Well, I got it in New Mexico. I was just down there, and just then another officer came in the room, and he quick picked it up and put it in his pocket." So the suggestion was that he was not supposed to have it, and that where it is today, we don't know. But June Crane handled this memory metal. She was around the scientists who all talked about what was going on there, and so she was in the right place at the right time, and we have a whole chapter in our book about her, how she came forward, why she broke her silence because she knew she was dying. So it constitutes almost a deathbed confession. So it's an intriguing story. A very courageous woman, and she was at the right place at the right time. And she was only one of two secretaries that we know who were at Wright-Patterson that have talked about it. There's only two that we're aware of, and she was one of them.
She said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands and survived cancer twice. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison?"
Yes. That's June Crane.
That's June Crane. What an extraordinary soul. I mean, this is an American. Pardon me.
Yes,
I shouldn't have a whole chapter on her. Yeah, I shouldn't have put it that way. But really, I mean, that to me expresses what this country is about. We'll be back with our guest, Tom Carey, inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson, with Don Schmidt, New Page Books, RoswellInvestigator.com, also on the front page at 21stCenturyRadio.com.
This is Kevin Randall, author of Conspiracy of Silence, Project Moondust. You are listening to 21st Century Radio's Dr. Bob Hieronymus, the best show on the air.
Oh, thank you, Kevin. Of course, I appreciate what he said. Well, of course, our guest is Tom Carey. And, of course, we're talking about Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson with Don Schmidt, New Page Books, etc. Now, there are so many good things here. Let's talk about who was Squiggly.
Squiggly. Well, Squiggly was the name that Marion Black Mac Magruder had dubbed the live alien that he saw at Roswell in April of 1948. Now, the way that came about was that I don't recall. Did I mention why Marion Magruder was at Wright-Patterson?
No, I don't think you did.
Yeah. During World War II, Magruder was a night fighter pilot. He commanded a night fighter unit that received a presidential citation for their action at Okinawa, specifically in the Pacific. Well, after the war, Magruder, being a Marine Corps pilot and a lieutenant colonel, he was thought to be one of the up-and-coming best and brightest of our officers to lead the Air Force or the Air Arm into the future. And he was assigned to the Air War College class of 1947-48. At Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. Well, in April of 48, the class has about another month to run. They flew the entire class of 90 officers. This would be officers ranking from lieutenant colonel up through general, up to Wright-Patterson, for some reason. They spent a week there, 5 days. Well, they were one day they were taken into this hangar. At least they thought it was a hangar, a building. And inside, they said, "Okay, what do we do now?" Well, they brought in some of this wreckage from the Roswell crash that they had recovered. They gave it to the officers and said, "Okay, fellas, we want you to look this over and tell us what you think." Well, they didn't know what to make out of it. Most of the officers hadn't heard of the Roswell incident. And they're thinking, wow, what is this stuff and where did it come from? And so finally, when they're through looking at it and asking one another, geez, boy, this is really something, they finally asked the instructor, "Well, what is it? Where did you get this?" And they said, it was recovered at a UFO crash the year before in New Mexico. He didn't say Roswell. He just said New Mexico the year before. Well, that would be the Roswell crash. Well, still wondering, what that stuff was, they're taken into another room. And here they are confronted with the live alien. And Marion Magruder, his description of it is very interesting, because it was given to his sons. He had five sons, Mike, Mark, Merritt, Marion Jr., and one other son who became, whose first name began with M. I can't remember it now, but it was on the occasion of the moon landing in July of 1969. And one of the sons asked Magruder, "Dad, do you think there's alien life in the universe?" He says, "Son, I know there's alien life in the universe, and here's why I know." So he then describes his trip to Wright-Patterson and his encounter with the one that was alive that was recovered from Roswell. And he gave the description as being squiggly. That's how he described its physical appearance, as squiggly, because it reminded him, when the thing moved, when it walked, it just reminded him of something rubbery, something with a sheen and rubbery. He just said squiggly. And so the other thing, the other interesting point about this is that they said, "Well, did it say anything? Did you talk to it?" And he says, "No, but we did make a mental connection." He says, "I made a mental connection with it, and I felt great sorrow for it and great empathy." And but they didn't converse like, you know, "How are you today?" or anything like that. He just said he felt a great empathy for it. And he also mentioned that that the thing lived for a couple of years, and that he used the term, "We killed it." And he said that because they were conducting experiments on it, and apparently one of the experiments on it resulted in its death. So that's why he said, "We killed it." And that was probably somewhere in the early 1950s, like 1952 or so. But that was Matt Magruder's description of the live one, and that he emphasized, although it was not human, he emphasized its human-like qualities, the fact that it had two arms, two hands, two legs, et cetera, et cetera. And he tried to emphasize its human-like qualities rather than its alien qualities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, debunkers tell us repeatedly that no ranking officers have ever reported seeing a UFO.
No ranking what?
Officers, military officers, have ever reported seeing a UFO. How accurate is that statement?
That is a bold-faced lie.
It is, of course, and they get away with it. No, that's what the most amazing thing is. They do get away with it throughout the media all the time.
Yes, that is a bold-faced lie, because there's all kinds of officers who have reported seeing UFOs in flight, and that, you know, in the Roswell case, we have them reporting seeing the wreckage of one on the ground. So this is just you know, when you come across a lie like that, there's no sense in debating it, because it's just categorically untrue.
Indeed, it is. Let's talk a little bit about Stringfield, Dr. Leonard Stringfield, who provides us with the physical attributes of these non-human victims of UFO crashes. What can you tell us about Dr. Stringfield?
Leonard Stringfield was a Cincinnati businessman, veteran of World War II, and the whole subject, the whole notion of crashed UFOs and alien beings became a taboo topic beginning in the 1950s. Now, why do I say that? Well, the 1950s, because people, you know, were kept reporting seeing these, they called them flying saucers. I think the term UFO was coined about 1951-52 in their by Edward Ruppelt in Project Blue Book. They were known as the contactees. Now, these were people who made up these stories about being taken aboard flying saucers and whisked around the solar system by their space brothers, who were always preaching peace and love, and they were coming to save us and all that sort of stuff. They would hold conventions out at Big Rock, California. I'm trying to think of some of their names. Howard Menger, George Adamski were a couple of the these contactees. Well, they were so bad. I mean, nobody believed them, but yet they wrote books, and the books sold. And they were absolutely derided unmercifully in the media. And the spinoff was that the major UFO proponent at the time, Donald Kehoe, would not touch the subject of crashed UFOs or reports of alien people seeing aliens, because it smacked too much of these contactee people. They're phony reports and their phony stories. So he never would touch the subject. Well, that was left to a fellow, a Cincinnati businessman, Leonard Stringfield, who, because of his contacts at Wright-Patterson, because of his proximity to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, he was accumulating stories of people who were there, were stationed there, who worked there, talking about seeing wreckage and alien bodies there, et cetera, et cetera. And so by the late 1970s, 1978 to be exact, he had enough to start publishing monographs about all these accumulated stories that originated from Wright-Patterson. And I believe there were a series of seven monographs from like 1978 to 1986 that detailed all of these stories that he had accumulated regarding UFO crashes that people were talking about, seeing UFO bodies, et cetera, et cetera. And the unfortunate part was that he didn't name names. He all of this, he printed these, most of them, 90% of them, without the name of the source. So you can imagine how much weight it carried if you come out with a story, but you won't name the source. That, mm-hmm. That's a big detriment to its credibility. Plus, these were limited circulation monographs. You had to be into the UFO scene to even know about them. Fortunately, I was, and I've got all seven copies. But because of Leonard Stringfield, the subject of crashed UFOs was now opened up. And it was only 2 years before the first, well, this actually would be the second UFO crash book to appear, known as the Roswell Incident, was published in 1980 by Grosset and Dunlap, William Moore and Charles Berlitz, the Roswell Incident. And I'm wondering if you could remember, here's a question for you, Bob, what was the first UFO crash book?
Oh, gosh, you got me on that one.
I'll give you the year, it was 1950.
1950,
Frank Scully and...
Frank Scully. Boy.
Frank Scully Behind the Flying Saucers, which was the so-called Aztec crash, which was thoroughly debunked a few years later by a journalist with the San Francisco Chronicle named J.P. Kahn, debunked it as a fiction created by two con men. So... you take the contactees plus the debunking of Behind the Flying Saucers crash, and the whole subject was taboo until Leonard Stringfield had the courage to come out and actually publish these seven monographs about it to at least get the subject in the consciousness of the people who were interested in this. Donald Kehoe was dead by then. And so a new generation of the investigators was coming forward, and here we are today.
Well, Stringfield put together, and you have it in a whole chapter on part chapter 19, dealing with a description, a pretty full description of what these rubbery type guys were like. Could you give us that description?
Yeah, Leonard Stringfield. He had a number of medical contacts at Wright-Patterson, and what he would do is that based on whatever information he had at hand, he would draw a schematic of what he thought the aliens looked like, and then he would submit it to his medical contacts at Wright-Patterson, and they would look at it and they would say, okay, the head's too big or the head's too small, and this is wrong and that's wrong and this is right. Well, finally, he got it right, and they said, okay, this is what it looked like. And we have that image in our book of the final schematic of what the Roswell aliens looked like. We have that picture in our book.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to hold this picture up to the microphone for our advanced listeners.
Anyway, he also gives a complete description from the autopsies that were completed on the aliens, and it's basically it's your 3.5 to 4 foot tall gray with an oversized head and no nose, just two little holes at the front of the face where the nose would be. No ears, just two holes at the side of the head where the ears would be. One-inch slit where the mouth would be, and deep, reset eyes set wide apart, slightly slanted. And again, these are 3.5 to 4 feet tall. And the coloration is given as various colors because of the state of decay of the alien plus the lighting in the room. So the colors range anywhere from greenish gray to purplish gray, to orange gray, to straight gray, but as far as the insides, they didn't have a digestive tract. You know, like we ingest food through our mouth. Well, the mouth in these things didn't go anywhere. It was just a cavity. The mouth didn't go anywhere. There was no digestive tract, no alimentary canal for the exit of waste products, things like that. Four fingers, four toes. And the arms were long, going down to longer than human arms. But the whole affair was about a being that weighed 35 to 40 pounds, somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely not human, but humanoid. Humanoid, but not human. And the head, again, was like an inverted pear. Just take a pear and invert it, you've got what the head looked like. Oversized.
Well, you've given several descriptions from different people all agreeing with each other in this particular area. And I'm being told right now we got to take the final break on 21st Century Radio. And we'll be right back with Tom Carey inside the real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson with Don Schmidt. New page books, RoswellInvestigator.com or on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com.
This is Whitley Strieber, author of Communion and the Key. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Where is he going to take you? You'll never guess.
Uncle Whitley, you know, his book, The Key, I think is an important work. Very few people have read it. It's a short book, but try to get a hold of it, because there's a certain aspect of his life that I think he exposes during that time, which was important. Our guest is Tom Carey. We're in our final segment of Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson, with Don Schmidt. And it's published by New Page Books, and of course you can find it on the front page at 21stCenturyRadio.com. There is a section in your book that I found fascinating, and it especially deals, this is on page 202, it deals with the goal of the Pentagon here, which, would you review this a little bit for us?
Well, they were Pentagon was faced with a threat that they had no idea what their motives were. Do we go public with it or do we cover this stuff up? And of course, they chose to cover it up. Whenever you don't know what's going on, you don't know, you're not in control, you cover it up. Mm-hmm. So we trace the history of the movements back and forth, the pro come clean crowd versus the cover it up crowd. You start with the Project Sign in 1948. That their conclusion, they came. That was the first Air Force study of the UFO phenomena up to that date, and their conclusion was that it was something real and not an illusion, and it was most likely interplanetary. Today we use the term extraterrestrial, but back then they used interplanetary. Well, the whole notion of covering this stuff up started with a fellow named four-star general, General Hoyt S. Vandenberg. And Vandenberg, at the time of the Roswell incident, was second in command of the Army Air Corps, right behind the Chief of Staff, General Carl Spatz. Both fellows from World War II. But Vandenberg was younger. Spatz was about to retire. So, in essence, Vandenberg was the chief, even at the time of the Roswell incident. Spatz was off fishing somewhere. So Vandenberg, his main concern was that he did not want to have panic in the streets. He remembered the Orson Welles Mercury Theater portrayal of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds starkly from 1938. He did not want panic in the streets. So he opted for covering the whole thing up, and maybe it'll go away. That's still with us today. And our book traces the evolution of the personalities, who was covering what. We reveal how Project Blue Book just became a public relations outfit, that the real cases were going somewhere else, who was in charge of what, and how the vagaries back and forth went and when they took place. Even after the Air Force claimed to have gotten out of the UFO business in 1969, how can you get out of that business when things are going on in the sky you've sworn to protect? So they still have a unit that investigates this stuff. They'd be derelict if they didn't.
Well, you did a damn good job on the Condon report, which is one of the most pathetic exercises in political favors.
If you read the Condon report, UFOs are true because a large percentage of the cases that they investigated were unknown.
Yeah, but
they were unknown. They still classified as unknown.
What was that? 23%.
Yes.
Yeah, 23%, and it's a far cry from the 1% that they were saying. So
yes, the military is great with doing hocus pocus with numbers.
You noticed that? All right, that's true.
They do hocus pocus with numbers, and you don't really know what they mean. They could be talking about the UFOs reported the week ago, just in the last week. But Project Blue Book, I think they had over 12,000. Reports of which somewhat over 700 were still classified as unknown when they closed shop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we got a lot of good cases since then, too. So, but as far as the military mindset, having been in the Air Force for a couple of years, the main mindset of officers and the career NCOs is to get the next promotion to the next grade. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get there by asking about UFOs. Like, hey, Colonel, what about that Roswell incident?
Yeah,
that's not going to get you a promotion. So there's no incentive for people in the Air Force or in the government to talk about this subject. They run as far away from it as they can. Look at the poor Dennis Kucinich, congressman from, what was it, Indiana, that he ran for president a couple times, and once it got out that he had had a UFO sighting, that was it for him. That's all the, whenever he was interviewed, that's all they wanted to talk about. Hey, you had a congressman, didn't you have a UFO sighting a couple of years back? And he would, by that time, tried to make a joke out of it. But it's poison. The subject of UFOs, and you know this, Bob, to professional people, to doctors, lawyers, academics especially, anybody that depends to a large degree on credibility, their own personal credibility for their livelihood, this subject is anathema. They just don't want to get near it.
As you note on page 202, you say, this apathetic behavior from two of the most influential groups in our society is precisely what the Pentagon had worked so hard to accomplish. No more press conferences necessary to explain away sighting reports. No chance of any academic studies looking into the subject. And that's what the Condon Committee basically did, was to ridicule and derisive propaganda. And as we found out, that really works in this country.
It does. It does. I'll give you two firsthand experiences.
Go right ahead.
In 2002, we conducted a full-scale archaeological dig out at the Mac Brazel crash site. This is where all the debris had rained down, and we thought that was the best site to conduct a scientific archaeological dig. In command of the University of New Mexico's Department of Archaeology. Well, you know, people on the one hand are crying, "Oh, why don't you ever use science in this UFO business? Why don't you get professional people?" Well, here's a case where we got the University of New Mexico, the PhDs in their Department of Anthropology led an archaeological dig, and they've been taking grief for participating ever since.
Yeah.
They've been taking grief. Why would you ever sign on to something like that? Well, you can't have it both ways. You can have it both ways. And more recently, we have come across something that is very interesting, and we wanted two professionals to examine these and give their opinion as to what it was. And these are professional people, and they pulled out. They said, well, when push came to shove, I mean, we were going to pay them handsomely to just conduct a study, but when push came to shove, they declined because they don't want their names sullied by anything having to do with the Roswell incident or UFOs, because they believe it smacks at their credibility. So the subject, I'm sorry to report that here in 2013, going on 2014, the subject is still held out to ridicule. If you're interested in this at all, there's something wrong with you, that you're not a serious person.
Well, that's not too much different from what's going on with global warming today, in which you have individuals who have not really done the research, basically sticking their head in the sand. And our children and our generations of children are going to pay for it.
Global warming, I don't know the specifics of it, but I do know, you know, from my studies that, you know, we've had, I guess, four separate ice ages, and in between you have warming periods, and even in the periods you have ups and downs. So mm-hmm. How much is part of the natural up and down of the long-term climate, and how much is the responsibility of humans? How much have we contributed to that? And I'm prepared to say, you know, I'm sure we have contributed to it, but how much I couldn't say.
Well, I could say, but I'm not going to get into that right now because we're in deep doo-doo right now, and we're just
we're
not paying any attention to it, not really. And especially when you see which groups are pushing it and how they were funded by Exxon etc. It's just a
yeah. You always have to look behind. You always have to look behind the facade. Okay, so who's pushing this? Who's funding it? And what's their agenda? I mean, that nothing, as you know, Bob, nothing happens in a vacuum, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't. You also, I think, J. Allen Hynek. What was well? What new information do you have about Dr. Hynek that we didn't know?
Don Schmidt was a disciple and a good friend of J. Allen Hynek. I never met the gentleman. I never knew him. I know him from swamp gas infamy. That's about all I knew personally of him when he tried to label the 1965-66 Hillsdale, Michigan, Ann Arbor, Michigan sightings. He just happened to say, well, you know, there's this phenomenon called swamp gas. Well, that sort of stuck with him for the rest of his life. But Don Schmidt knew him well, and there's a lot of new information in the book about Hynek. Was he a dupe? Or was he just an accomplice? Actually, in my opinion, he was both. His job as a consultant to the Air Force's Project Blue Book was to help debunk UFOs that were being reported to it. Well, at some point he said, well, look, there's got to be better cases than the ones that I'm being asked to look at. There's got to be better cases somewhere, and where are they going? They're not coming here. And finally, he had enough, and he went to see Donald Rumsfeld, who was I think he ultimately became the Secretary of Defense.
You sure did.
And Hynek said, "Look, I've been on this project for X number of years. I've been a loyal soldier. Please tell me what is going on here. In my opinion, there's something to this. It's not the swamp gas. It's not the weather balloons. It's not geese up in the sky. What is going on here, Mr. Rumsfeld?" And he said, Rumsfeld said, "Well, Alan, I'm sorry, but you don't have a need to know." That was his answer. "You don't have the need to know." And that was it. End of meeting, end of conversation. Hynek goes out, slams the door, and he says, "They're making patsies of me all over again." He felt that they were making, he was a patsy, that the real stuff was going elsewhere, which was true, and that he was just a patsy. And he wanted to know the answer. He never did find out from his superiors in the military or in the government what the final answer was or what they knew. He just knew that he was being, he was not in the loop of really knowing what was going on.
And with that, that's all the time we got. Tom, thank you for joining us. This is a great book. I'm glad I read it, and I hope everyone else does. We'll see you next week on 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zahara Hieronymus. You gotta spread the word.
Tell them what you heard. We're gonna make a better day. Stimulating talk around the clock. And breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio 1, Bill Vitka. Health.